It's now my honor to introduce Dr. Forrest Roer. Dr. Roer is a professor of biology at San Diego State University. He uses viromics to study ecosystems ranging from the human body to coral reefs, and has shown that most genomic diversity on the planet is viral. Dr. Roer has published over 200 peer-reviewed articles, has won numerous national and international awards, and is listed as one of the world's most influential scientific minds. He will present personalized phage-based therapies. And please type any questions you might have in the chat box as they come up. And if we have time at the end, we'll get to them. So welcome, Dr. Roer.
Hey, thank you. Hello, everybody. It's, of course, a little weird because I'm doing the Zoom thing. So I'm going to go through some of the newer data that we have on trying to use personalized approaches in understanding CF and providing some guidance for possibly treatment, including things with phage. And just as a rough background, because I can never quite know who the audience is, I'll just go through some of the things that we know from previous work and how we're actually using that now. So as everybody here is aware, the mucus of this of a CF lung is kind of sticky, so it doesn't move as well, and it gets heavily colonized by viruses and microbes over time. And the most of those viruses are phage. The other thing that's interesting about CF from a scientific point of view, maybe not if you happen to have the disease, is that it harbors these unique viral and microbial communities that change over time. So plotted here is just like an old study that we did, but you'd get basically the same thing no matter what you do. If you go in and you get into sputum and you start sequencing the DNA that's there, you'll find all these different types of bacteria and viruses that are in the lungs, and that changes as you move through time as an individual patient. So what that really means is that everybody has both a personalized disease that needs to be diagnosed, and you're going to need personalized treatments. And that's really become more apparent now that we have the Trikafta, because that's really changed the game, where the number of people that are going to be super sick is going to go down significantly, making this more likely as a real approach to being able to treat it. This is our working model of how we think you should do the diagnosis, and we call this the CF rapid response. The idea here is to get and characterize the microbiology and the biochemistry of this of a sample in about 48 hours. So what we get is we get into sputum, and then we do the metabolomes, so that's the chemistry, the metagenomes, the DNA of the bacteria and viruses that are there, as well as the metatranscriptome, and then kind of a specialized thing, which we call the viriome, which is just the viruses. And then we've set up a number of pipelines to analyze this data. And the one that we use the most in case of cystic fibrosis is that is this one that I'm showing here, which we call FRAP. And what FRAP does is it takes a genome of a bacteria or a virus, and then it takes all of these small reads that we get from that sequencing, and it compares against all of the known genomes. And that gives you a really accurate taxonomical as well as functional analysis of the microbial community. Now, the complication in CF, the clinical complication is really you kind of have the stable disease and then you have the exacerbations. And the exacerbations come in basically two flavors. There are the chronic exacerbations, people that have the, these are fairly frequent, and they go, they're basically characterized on, you get a loss in lung function, but most of the time they'll respond to the treatments that you were using before, and you'll recover most of that lung function. And we think that most of this is due to cycling between fermentative and non-fermentative communities. And I'll show you a little bit of what that looks like in a second. And then there are the acute exacerbations, which is where there's a massive or there's a really rapid loss of lung function, and it often doesn't recover fully. There's usually a delay or no response to the treatments that have been using before. And we know that a lot of this is actually related to the phage, so the viruses that infect the bacteria. So this is something that I presented last year, and I was just going to remind everybody, this is what it would look like when you use a CFR, rapid response to look at one of these acute infections. In this case, what happened is a CFR got infected with an E. coli. The E. coli had a phage that was turned on when the antibiotics, when they were treated with the antibiotics. And that activation of the phage actually led to complications that were fatal in the end. And we know that this is really common with acute infections. So these are just a number of different CF responses that we've looked at. And what we're finding is that about like 40 to 50% of these real acute infections can be directly related to phage. But today I want to go through a little bit more about these more common chronic exacerbations. So these are the ones that you, where people are just cycling over the course of their life, where they're going up and down a little in lung function. And these chronic exacerbations are a little bit trickier to understand initially. What we really think is what we call the fermentation model of chronic CF exacerbations. And the idea here is that the microbial community is producing products. These are metabolites, mostly secondary metabolites, that actually cause the disease and the people the feeling bad by the patients. And the way this would look is a lot of these a lot of these metabolites fall into these things that we would call fermentation products. And that's led to this nomenclature that we're using in the CF research workshop that we have in Telluride this year. And really the idea is that you have things that we call brewers. And you guys might know these as the Streptococcus, Staphylococcus, et cetera. And what these types of bacteria are is that they can go in and they can colonize healthy tissue and even healthy mucus. They can do it better in CF, and they'll go in and they'll start eating that and they'll turn it into fermentation products. And those fermentation products can then feed what we're calling the drunkards. And the drunkards are your pseudomonads, things like Rothia, things that can actually build the biofilms. So they put out extracellular matrices, which then block off oxygen. So you get really low oxygen. And that leads to this final step, which are these strip anaerobes, which we call the putrefiers. And these guys, you know, because they're the ones that really, whenever you smell something that's been rotting, that's all of those secondary metabolites that are being released by these guys. So Villanelle, Profitella would be examples of this. And we know pretty well that this happens in general in microbial ecology, and specifically in CF also. So Ryan Hunter's lab has really looked at the colonization event where the brewers set up the system so that the Pseudomonas and other drunkards can come in and set up those biofilms that then cause a lot of the disease as well as blocking the airways. And then Katrina Whiteson's lab, as well as a group of people working with her, have really been looking for these secondary metabolites. And you can detect these in people's breath gases is the main place that we've been looking at them. So this is what a CF rapid response with a chronic exacerbation patient will look like. And this one is an unusual patient. So what's going on with them is that they have chronic exacerbations that occur almost every 6 weeks. And so that frequency is really damaging to both the person's lifestyle, as well as over time they're accumulating damage in their lungs. So the idea is, can we actually fix this and come up with a way to stop this rapid cycling of this exacerbation cycle? So the study is divided basically up into three periods. So in the first period, the patient is in the hospital, where they've lost about half of their lung function as measured by FEV1, and they're put on this suite of antibiotics. This works and the patient recovers, and they're taken off antibiotics and sent home. And within about 6 days after being released from the hospital, there's another rapid decline in the FEV1. And with the coughing and the shortness of breath associated with this. And this is what was really typical with this patient. As long as they were on this really high antibiotic dose, they would not have the symptoms. As soon as you took them off and let them recover a little bit, they would go back into this really, this chronic exacerbation. And in this case, in the third period, oral clindamycin treatment was initiated, and pretty rapidly the patient really started feeling better. The coughing and shortness of breath abated, and and they actually stopped having these chronic exacerbations for over 5 months. So how do we do this, and what do we learn from it? So this is what the first CF rapid response data looked like. So induced sputum was taken, and then this metatranscriptome sequence was done. And in this case, what we're doing is we're just looking at the RNA that's going on in the, that is happening in the induced sputum. And so remember that fragment recruitment. So what we've got is we've got all the genomes, and then with the genomes, are in our database. Now we take all the fragments from the metatranscriptome sequencing, and we're just looking to see, are they matching those sputum? Are they matching those genomes? And we just measure how well that those fragments cover the genome. And for example, this would be all of the Rothia genome, and all of this would be the coverage across it. This was at day 16. And what you can see is from the first CF rapid response, really, this patient has what we would call a putrefier, this guy here, and drunkard sort of system. So the Rothia is the drunkard, and it is eating the fermentation product that's coming from the villanella. And in turn, it's creating the biofilm that's keeping the oxygen tension low, so that the oxygen tension high, so that the system is remaining anaerobic. And so this combination of these two sets up a system that that is quite stable. And when the long-term antibiotic treatment was done, it actually managed to clear that out pretty well. So that's what we are seeing just before the patient is released from the hospital. So what happens in the next step is as soon as the person went home, we see this rise of basically one of these brewers. So these are, remember, things that just start fermenting the mucus and then allow the drunkards to come in. So they're going to be eating the products. And in this case, it was a streptococcus. That's really common. Everybody has lots of streptococci, as well as staphylococcus. That's one of the other ones that is the main one we always notice. And so what we think is just happening in this case is the streptococcus comes in. It's attacking those spaces where there had been previously the villanella and the rothia, and it starts fermenting mucus. And then that creates fermentation products that that lead to the rise of the Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So it's just kind of a typical succession event that we would expect to see. And in this case, we've got rise of Pseudomonas supported by Streptococcus. Now, at the same time, I just want you to notice that there's still a little bit of that original community there. So we have both a little bit of Rothia and Villanelia there. So now we have two communities that are growing in this person's lungs. All right, so one of the ideas from the microbiology and really comes out of this working group in Telluride is that really we may be able to kill what's the weakest link. So instead of focusing on these tough bugs like Pseudomonas and Rothia to kill, we'll go for things that are easier, which tend to be things like Streptococcus, and any of the anaerobes tend to be easier to kill. So in this case, we know that clindamycin will kill both Streptococcus and the Villanelia. Okay? And that should indirectly knock out the things that are eating the fermentation products, right? So the Rothia and the Pseudomonas should not have anything to eat because you've killed the brewers and the putrefier that are feeding them. So this is an indirect way to control the drunkards. And the other advantage is that, remember earlier I showed you that one of the main problems we're having is that we're inducing phage, and I'll explain why this is true in a little bit. But if you start inducing phage, you run into a real problem of causing other virulence factors to be expressed. So this is, this will, because of how the clindamycin works as a translational inhibitor, it will also stop the phage from getting activated. So the idea is that we should be able to deliver a punch where we knock out the fermenters, and then we take that indirectly takes out the drunkards, so the things that are eating the fermentation products, and we stop any unknown phage activity. And that's effectively what happened in this case. So in this part here, you can see that this is where right in this time frame is when clindamycin was added, and that knocked out those fermenting anaerobic bacteria, and that indirectly takes out the Rothia and the Pseudomonas. So by the end of day 40 here, there's basically none of those guys there at all. So it seemed to work quite well. Okay. All right, this is what it looks like at another level. So the metatranscriptomes are the RNA, so they're pretty rapidly turned over. So it tells you what's actively growing in that induced sputum when you take it. But then more and more integrated time is the DNA, because that's the DNA is more stable over time. And so what you can see is when you look at the metagenomes, you get that exactly what we see with the metatranscriptomes. We just see a little bit more of the Staphylococcus. So here we've got the Rothia with a little bit of Pseudomonas in that initial time point, and you have Staph and Strep and Villanelia in at this time. The other thing we've done is we've counted the number of cells that are there, and so then we can normalize the number of cells by the relative abundance that we get in the metagenomes. And what you see is that over time, you clear it out with that first big cocktail. And then as soon as you take that antibiotic cocktail away, you get the rise of those brewer sort of bacteria. And then when you go and you target them with the clindamycin, they go back down, and you end up with knocking down the total microbial load by about an order of magnitude over with that one treatment. This is to show a little bit more detail about this. So the clindamycin did stop the fermentation. So fermentation for the most most fermentations produce different types of gases. Think of like CO2 in your beer fermentation. And so you can actually see those. And we use this thing called the WinCF model, where we take induced sputum, we mix it in with something that looks like an artificial sputum media, and then put them in these tubes, which creates a gradient of oxygen. And that allows us to create anaerobic and aerobic conditions together. And then in this case, we look for how much gas is in that tube. And we can just quantify how much gas is in the tube, and that becomes the fermentation gas volume over here. And what you can see is that this was that initial period. So they did have some fermentation when they first came to the hospital. The initial cocktail knocked it down significantly. As soon as they head home and they're off antibiotics, the community starts fermenting again. And then this is where you add the clindamycin, which then knocks it back down. And so you can really see this switch in the fermentation. And then this is just another way of looking at this with a little bit more detail, where we take the induced sputum and we use a GC mass spec system to ask what are the actual products. And really what's interesting is here's the fermentation products that were that we could observe when we had that cocktail. This is all of these crazy, a lot of different fermentation products during that period when they were off antibiotics. And then this is what happens when you hit them with clindamycin. So really we can see this really rise in fermentation as well as a whole bunch of fermentation products, which is feeding those drunkards, and it's probably making the patient feel bad because you have all of those things going into their bloodstream. So we think that you can use this thing of targeting the brewers and the putrefiers to control some of the chronic exacerbations. Okay. So what are the phage doing during this thing? And this gets a little complicated. So I hope everybody's with me. I'm going to, I'll leave some time for questions, I hope. So the typical way that people think about phage working is really in something that's much more like a predator-prey sort of cycle. And this is called kill the winner in the phage biology world. It's called Locke of Volterra, classically in ecology. And if you've heard of it, it's probably been in this concept where if you imagine that you have something like a whole bunch of rabbits, where they're growing, 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 as soon as you have an increase in that population, you'll see an increase in the population of the predators. Predators will come along until at one point they eat so many of the rabbits, that population crashes, then of course all the predators will starve to death, and then that allows the prey item to come back up. And so this dynamic is called kill the winner in the phage world. And really that's what most people are assuming is happening when you're doing a phage therapy. So the idea would be, I'll just add a whole bunch of predators and that will cause that crash in my prey population. Okay. However, we know that that's actually not the only way that phage can make a living. So unlike a regular predator, like a fox, phage do all these other things. So, and actually all viruses can do this, or most viruses. So what a virus does, like a phage, is it goes in and it tries to find a host cell. And when it finds one that that tastes right, what it'll do is it'll absorb to it. And once it's absorbed, it can inject its nucleic acids inside in the infection step. Now, if we were just thinking about just a regular predator-prey sort of interaction, things like kill the winner, what would happen is that phage DNA would take over the cell. It would make a whole bunch of copies of itself. It would make a whole bunch of new phage and then would blow the cell up. So this is a lytic cycle, and it would be indicative of kill the winner. However, there's another thing which is very common with viruses, which is that instead of doing the lysis, they actually go temperate, or they're temperate, and they form lysogens. So what happens in this case is they inject the nucleic acid, and they integrate usually into the host genome, and they become a provirus or a prophage. And then at some point, they can replicate with the host, until at some point they're induced and they re-enter the lytic life cycle. There's a whole bunch of terminology here. I know it's a little confusing, but really one of the main things that we know from other systems is that if we look at the number of free viruses versus the number of cells, that if we've got this lytic thing going, we're actually producing a lot of viruses and we have fewer cells because they've been blown up. So we get a larger ratio of the viruses to microbe. However, if we've got this temperate behavior where the viruses are basically becoming part, they're in a symbiosis with the bacterial host, what we get is we get a smaller one because we're not producing more phage and we're not killing off the bacteria as much. So that's the first indication of whether, which type of dynamic we have going on. And just to give you a feel, that when we start looking at these direct counts, so this is where we're counting the viruses directly and the number of, or the phage directly and the number of bacteria directly. And what we see is that when people are in a stable CF community, we've got a low virus to microbe ratio, saying that basically these guys are temperate. They're behaving as lysogens, so they're inside the host as prophage. And during the exacerbations, that's going up, and that's because the viruses are lysing the host. So what we think is that the phage are more virulent / lytic during the exacerbation events. And that's not really good. Okay, so I'm gonna go give you some terrible stuff here and hopefully not drive you to an early bear. Okay, so how this works at the molecular level is this, that if you have a certain amount of food going into a bacteria cell, so just imagine it's a piece of a sugar molecule going in, it can be digested all the way, broken down all the way to produce a whole bunch of ATP. And so if to produce a whole bunch of ATP, what you need is you need oxygen. So you have to take the sugar in, it has to go through all of these biochemical steps called like glycolysis in the TCA cycle. And you end up with about, with from one sugar molecule, about 34 ATP. When that happens, but the phage tend to behave lytically. So there's a really well, this is really well characterized kind of at the molecular level. So we know that if there's a lot of ATP, that the phage will remain lytic. So the way to think about it in the case of the CF lung is that if there's oxygen, there's ATP, and you're gonna get phage killing, kill the winner dynamics. Okay. However, if there's a lot of food, but not much oxygen, what happens is that the sugar comes in, very little ATP is produced, and it's actually the sugar and the byproducts are used to build more cell. So that's anabolic metabolism. So anabolic metabolisms have been under anaerobic conditions, right? That's why you lift weights at the gym, is to get an anabolic sort of metabolism going in your muscles. So under those circumstances, the viruses tend to stay with the cell. So that's when they're temperate. So just from our point of view, if there's lots of extra food, that means that there's not very much ATP. So there'll be more cyclic AMP produced. And that means that the viruses are behaving temperately. And there you've got piggyback the winner sort of dynamics. So everything that you've got going in a chronic, in one of these chronic infections, is really creating these conditions where the combined activity of the brewers and the putrefiers, which are producing food as fermentation products, and the drunkards, which are blocking the oxygen coming in the system, they lead to the temperate behavior. Okay. And the problem with this from the point of view of a human or an animal cell is that temperate viruses have to, when they're inside the cell, they have to protect that cell. So lysogens the viruses have changed their whose side they're on, right? It's a true symbiosis. So what they have to do is they have to protect that cell from other phage attacking it, right? So if you're doing phage therapy, those phage are actually protecting the lysogens from the phage that you're adding. And the other thing is that they're protecting against engulfing cells, because that's one of the main things ways that bacterial cells die. Engulfing cells come in, engulf them, and then eat them. And so in the environment, that's protists. In the body, that's macrophages, right? Basically, by definition, if you have a high density microbial system, you have to have these anti-predator systems for the lysogens, or they would all die. They just keep getting eaten by everything. So this is just the way that this it's forced by evolution and the evolutionary dynamics, and it's cued on by that biochemistry that I was telling you. And I showed you at the beginning that CF lungs are actually very dense microbial communities. And so basically what we know is that all of the cells in those communities, when they're stable, are lysogens, and they have multiple things to protect them from predators, including the macrophages as well as other phage. And so when you start to break up those communities, the viruses detect that, and they start expressing things that will kill off eukaryotic cells. That's exactly what happened in that acute thing that I talked to, that acute example I talked to you at the beginning. That was a Shiga toxin. The Shiga toxin was expressed, and that killed off the human cells just by inducing the phage. And basically all of the major bacterial pathogens you know about are made by bacteria acquiring prophage that carry toxins. So it's going to be important to protect, stop prophage activation when we start breaking up the CF communities. We've already seen that in about 40% of the cases, that really matters. And one of the ways you might be able to do that is just use something that will stop translation, like clindamycin. All right, so here's just an example to show you a little what it looks like, and I'll go... this is not a CF patient. This is actually someone that got a transplant but was infected with Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And I'm just going to go through this a little bit to give you a feel of what's going on in a CF during a phage therapy trial. So in this case, the patient is going to be treated with these cocktails of phage, and they're either intravenously or through a nebulizer. And they were actually two phage treatments. That's not going to be important for this talk, but we're going to focus on this part right here. So they've got a lung transplant, they're immunosuppressed, they're trying to use phage to control the Pseudomonas aeruginosa. They add Pseudomonas aeruginosa phages. And when they do that, what you see is that when we look in the lungs of those patients, so the phage have been given intravenously, we see that the phage are making it into the lungs, which is great, right? So you can put them in intravenously and you can get into the lungs. This shows you that at about day four, we're getting pretty good phage enrichment within the lungs. And those phage are able to kill Pseudomonas aeruginosa. That's been confirmed. So we can get things in there, and they can be they can kill off the Pseudomonas. Okay. The downside are a couple things. So one is that we notice that when we get those phage in there, it's triggering the other prophage that are in the lysogens. So this just gives you an example. This is where we're looking at this line here is just the phage that we added to the system. And then here are the phage that were already in the system. So they're prophage. And you can see that they're becoming activated when the phage therapy was done. Since we're worried about turning on these phage, we really should think about doing a CF rapid response before we start, to make sure we don't have any of these exotoxins in the system. And two, maybe using prophylactic clindamycin. And this then shows you how complicated these dynamics actually get. So the patient did survive in this case. However, it's not clear that the phage were actually that important because we saw this thing, which I hope it becomes apparent what happened. So what happened is, of course, we added the phage, it killed off some Pseudomonas, and then all of a sudden we saw this burst of Pseudomonas right after. So even though that there's more phage there, and it didn't make the clinical case better, but it's actually not clear that it actually helped in any way. And in fact, it may be that what happened is by adding the Pseudomonas phage, you actually cleared some space for probably some of those brewer-like microbes. So Staphylococcus or Streptococcus came in and they started fermenting, which led to this burst of different Pseudomonas numbers later on. So this just shows you this complication. I know it's complicated, but it is interesting. We're starting to understand it well enough that maybe we can manipulate it. So this is just a summary that CF really, if we want to get really understand these, especially these fewer number of cases that we're hopefully having, it's a personalized disease that is often associated with phage that have virulence factors associated with them. The chronic exacerbations are really seem to be caused by the cycling between fermentative and non-fermentative communities. And we can target those by hitting basically the anaerobes to get rid of the fermentation products. This low oxygen in these stable communities is encouraging the temperate life cycles, and anything that disrupts this, whether that's antibiotics or other phage therapies, could lead to exotoxin expression and unintended consequences, unintended damages. And so maybe it would be a good idea to prophylactically treat with things like clindamycin before you start those studies. All right, of course, there's a ton of people involved in this. These are the main ones here. Doug Conrad is the doctor at UCSD who guides all these studies. Cynthia is now a professor at University of Miami. Anna Cobain is at the University of Pennsylvania, and Rick Westman's lab as a postdoc. And then Angus Segal has been doing all the phage biology. Much of this work comes out of the Telluride CF Working Group. And thank you to Ryan and Katrina for organizing that, as well as funding by CFRI and the Spruance Foundation. And then finally, I know this is really complicated stuff. So if you really want to understand it better, I've got basically a book that you can download for free at this website here that really will help you. It's kind of a working document of how we think all these dynamics are working. Okay. And with that, I will end.
Oh, thank you, Forrest. A couple things. One is, could you type or copy and paste that link into the chat?
I can try. I can do it after. How's that?
Okay, that's cool. That's cool. The second thing I wanted to say is, of those three people, Doug, Cynthia, Anna, and Anka, I just want to brag that CFRI has funded three of those four.
Yes.
So that's awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't see any questions in the chat. So if you guys have any questions, please put them in the chat and they'll be funneled to me to read to Forrest. I had one. What would happen if people, I mean, it seems like a drug like clindamycin could be hugely important in just stopping the whole process. But would that upset the balance of everything? Like, could we take it like we take azithromycin, for instance? Or would that just upset the whole balance and cause all kinds of other problems?
Yeah, so it's, it is a really good question. And it's a challenge for everybody right now, because previously we've been basically focused on how do we keep the microbial loads down. Now, it's not just keeping the microbial loads down, it's keeping them in something that is the microbes that are there, probably more on like scarred parts of the lung, the remodeled areas. How do we keep those things as something that doesn't make it worse, right? You know what I mean? So what is gonna be, we know that we'll get colonization of the lung any place that we have the scar tissue, but then how do we get the ones that we want and keep the numbers way down is a real, really, it's a challenge right now. And I don't have a good answer to, I do have some ideas, but I still think we're not, we need to get over this understanding of what the Trikafta is gonna do and how many patients are we gonna have that are still getting the real severe exacerbations. And then past that, how do we think about the long-term? That we have no data really, and what's gonna happen with these microbial communities on these guys, yeah. I mean, everybody is gonna have, it's gonna be a challenge for everybody from the doctors to the researchers. The other thing that we're running into is how do we study them? So there's like this really good problem, right? So as you know, we're losing the induced sputums. And so to really see what's going on with the microbiology, is it gonna be that we, so what we're thinking as a group is really moving into those secondary metabolites, because you can tell from when someone's breathing out what types of microbes they have, not necessarily what species and all of that, but definitely what types. And then we should be able to also couple that, like Heather Bean is doing a lot of this now, where you hit the system with an antibiotic, and then you see a shift in the types of metabolites that are being exhaled. And then again, you're getting an idea of how the community is shifting without getting deep into the microbiology, like the taxonomy and stuff, which I think will be super useful too. So it's gonna be, it's interesting times, right? I really, hopefully, like we'll be out of business soon. It's what I keep hoping.
We'll all have to have a little breathalyzer test at our quarterly visit. And
yeah, you know, we really have been looking at doing that even in the clinic, just hooking basically the, when you do the FEV1, yeah. Mm-hmm. Coupling that to like a GC mass spec system and just looking at the same time to see what's there. And that would be really a nice routine measurement to be using, because it doesn't, it's not invasive. It would be just part of the normal thing. Of course, it's a little costly. So we're looking at, that won't be coming to all the clinics, but hopefully we'll get that going in a couple of the clinics now.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. Rob Robinson asks, is oxygen therapy, does that retard the brewers, suppress the active brewers?
So probably not. The challenge is that you know, those, when you build those biofilms, it's really hard to get oxygen. They kind of sit at that interface. So the brewers are facultative, right? So they can deal with anaerobic and aerobic conditions. Mm-hmm. The oxygen, especially if you were to use hyperbaric oxygen, would be able to kill off the putrefiers. There's some challenges to using hyperbaric oxygen though, especially in CF patients. So we have to be worried about embolisms and stuff like that with the obstructions that everybody has. That being said, yes, you know, oxygen is in general going to be useful for getting the phage to kill things. It's going to be useful for getting rid of those really nasty putrefying ones, actually, because those guys are the ones that are producing those really kind of terrible secondary metabolites that like directly damage the tissue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is flagyl ever used clinically to go after those guys?
Say that again.
Is flagyl or some antibiotic that's more for anaerobic?
Not that I know of. But it's really starting to, you know, people are really, I mean, the data is so strong anymore that the anaerobes are important, that lots of people are experimenting more. You know, honestly, 10 years ago, if you would have said there's anaerobes there, people would say, no, there's not. That's, you're just switching the field's thought pattern about how it's working. So I think that, that it's enough people know that that's how it's working, that people are starting to investigate possibilities there. Yeah. Someone mentioned in the STOP2 talk, right, about targeting anaerobes, honestly.
Okay, we have a couple questions here from William Ho. Can't you take a breath sample in a bag and send it out for mass spec or carbon-based medium that would later off-gas the substrate for mass spec?
Yes, absolutely. And that's actually what Heather Bean is doing. She's using one of these Mylar bags to do exactly that.
Cool. Great. Yeah.